Hello, everybody, and welcome to this podcast on the history of actor training in the British Drama School. This has been a fairly momentous week in the history of the British Drama School because Ed Kemp, who was the director of RADA, formerly for a year artistic director and then director of the whole thing, has resigned after 14 years. And that's quite a big deal because RADA, as we all know, exercises a strange sort of pressure on the perception of drama schools, and fairly uniquely sort of also occupies a space, I think, in the national consciousness. And RADA is a fascinating place, and at some point I'm going to have to try and sort of dig into the question of what RADA is. I might call the episode something like, "When Was RADA?" This is something I'm going to steal from a Welsh historian's investigation into Wales called "When Was Wales?" It was a lecture I went to when I was young. I thought it was rather brilliant. So I'd like to sort of find out what RADA is, because I think maybe uniquely among drama schools, as well as being sort of the most famous one, it's also the one with the least really identifiable sort of ethos. It's a fascinating place, and also generates in a really curious way a huge amount of perceptions and misperceptions. So I think RADA is equally sort of reviled and revered, sort of desired and despised. Other pairs of words I'm sure we could come up with, and the reasons for that I think are really complicated actually. But in a minute, I'm going to read you something that might at least explain one version of RADA or how RADA is perceived. But yes, Ed resigned, Ed Kemp resigned, and it's probably worth just pausing to reflect on that. In the stage, he said that leaving RADA would be a wrench, but felt that the time is ripe for the school to benefit from new perspectives and fresh thinking. Ed plans to pursue personal writing and directing projects. I presume this is probably from a press release, but the stage goes on to say, he recently oversaw RADA's transition to becoming an independent higher education institution for the first time in its history. Lambda's done that too. That's going to become quite an interesting part of the future of the British Drama School. So RADA and Lambda have left larger organising institutions, the Conservatoire for Dance and Drama recently, and have also sort of broken from their relationships with the universities that validated their degrees. And now they're moving towards, maybe have already achieved, a place where they can offer degrees themselves. I think that's going to lead to more changes, but we'll see how that goes. And then the stage goes on to say, and led the establishment of the college's film, TV and radio department in 2008. We spoke recently to Ed Hicks, who was a big part of that story, as well as the creation of the RADA Studios facility on Cheyne Street. A major redevelopment of the wider Cheyne Street site is also in the works, but was paused during the pandemic. Announcing his departure, Kemp said, running RADA is one of the best jobs in the world, and I've relished my time at the helm. Over the last 14 years, the Academy has changed and progressed, and our many achievements have come from the combined efforts of staff, students, graduates, supporters and friends, to all of whom I would like to express my gratitude. I believe now is the right moment to pass to someone else the privilege of guiding the future of this remarkable institution. It is a time of great change in the industry, and RADA faces new and exciting opportunities which will benefit from new perspectives and fresh thinking. Sort of what you would expect, really, from somebody resigning from a major organisation. Of course, within that, there's real resonance, because RADA's going through huge changes, as are all drama schools. The world is changing. We're deep in lockdown 3. If anybody listens to this in, I don't know, 5 years' time or 10 years' time, or I don't know how long these things last. This is a particularly bleak time in the United Kingdom. The daily deaths from coronavirus are shocking and worrying and terrible. And we're all sort of stuck in our houses with our families, desperately trying to find a way to keep going, really, I think is probably what's going on. It's interesting with Ed, and I mean this as an observation. I think it's a curious thing that he's only the sixth sort of director principal of the school. The title changes, but I think the role is is similar-ish. So the head of RADA, there have been six people, or seven, if you include a Birbaum tree right at the beginning. But once the school got going, very early on, it appointed a man called Kenneth Barnes, the brother of the Vanbrugh sisters, fascinatingly. And since then, there's only been six principals, all of whom have been men and all of whom were graduates of Oxford. Now, I've sort of been ever so slightly taken to task about mentioning that. It's not meant to be a dig at anybody. It's merely an observation. Although, of course, I think that certainly could be adduced as evidence of either something that you might call cultural capital, or privilege, or something to do with the way RADA wanted to be seen in the world. Because it certainly can't be a pure statistical fluke that six people all are graduates of Oxford. But anyway, I thought I'd just talk briefly about those principles. And then I'd like to read a communication between George Bernard Shaw and William Pole from, or about RADA, about the teaching of RADA, which mentions Kenneth Barnes and the principal's office. And then I'm going to go into finishing reading and maybe discussing slightly Michel Saint-Denis' account of the work of the Old Vic School. So this podcast's going to be in two parts. I hope it won't be too long, but it'll be partly about RADA principles and this particular conversation between Pole and Shaw, and then we'll have a listen to Michel Saint-Denis' views on actor training. Part of the reason why I'm doing it this way is that the document I have, the letter from William Pole to George Bernard Shaw about RADA, is very rare, or rather it's a very rare type of document, because RADA was bombed in 1941, the Gower Street building, which is where the Academy moved very shortly after its foundation, was bombed in 1941, and it was a big bomb, and there was a big fire, and nearly everything was destroyed. So, rather agonizingly for anybody interested in these things, interested in the history of RADA or drama schools in general, there isn't much material from before the war, which obviously was a really interesting time. But there is this letter that comes from another archive. There's only one half of it, and it's the letter from William Pole to George Bernard Shaw. But in that, he talks in a really interesting way about teaching within the Academy. The letter dates from 1932, which is the same time that Michel Saint-Denis was bringing over his Théâtre de Caz to the Art Theatre and other places. And that was going to sort of cause this earthquake in the British theatre, or certainly in British actor training, that we're still involved in. The tremors, the after tremors of that, are still very much present in the British drama school. In fact, I was reading this morning, just by chance, I was reading the prospectus for the MA Classical Acting at Central, and in that they avowedly reference Michel Saint-Denis. So the sort of the fascination is that at the time when this sort of revolution was happening or about to happen, at the same time in the letter between Shaw and Pole, you get a very clear idea of what the theatre establishment, or certainly RADA, was like at that time, and perhaps why in some ways it was so reviled. This is around the same time that someone like Joan Littlewood came to RADA and just hated it. And I think when people, it's so funny with RADA, I was working with some actors the other day, and one of them was from RADA, and one of the actors said, sort of voce, in a sort of playful way, "Ooh, fancy." And I thought, isn't that interesting that school, it still generates, even in quite a sort of comedic way, this particular response. And the reasons for that are, I think, probably largely historical. I think RADA as a modern institution has done all sorts of interesting things. So we're gonna just discuss RADA principles, and then listen to a chat between William Pole talking about Shakespeare and George Bernard Shaw. And then, if we have time, we'll return to listening to Saint-Denis' views on the Old Vic School. That may all sound a bit much. We'll see how we get on. Anyway, I think this stuff is interesting. So have a listen. So, yes, six principles of RADA. So the Academy of Dramatic Art was set up by Sir Herbert Birbaum-Tree in 1904. We've mentioned that briefly in the story of Rosina Philippi. So it was set up in the dome of His Majesty's Theatre and then moved to Gower Street the following year, in 1905. In 1909, Sir Kenneth Barnes was appointed. And he served, it's extraordinary, he served from 1909 to 1955. So 46 years, whatever that quite comes out. Extraordinary. Nearly 50 years, Kenneth Barnes was the principal of RADA. And Kenneth Barnes was was born in 1878, which makes him, actually, you'll hear later, sort of a slight young'un when it comes to some of the other folk knocking around. So he was nearly 80 when he was still working at RADA. He was the brother of the Vanbrugh sisters. So you're a really sort of Victorian figure in some ways. I think it was Barnes's tenure that led to some of the very particular criticisms of RADA, especially in the 1950s. You can imagine all sorts of things were happening in the world. And this very liked man, my sense from reading obituaries, which of course are coded things, but also letters about him and some accounts you can find, is that Kenneth Barnes was a very sort of decent and popular and liked and good leader of that institution. But the school itself was coming in for increasing criticism at that period. And that led to the appointment of John Fernald, or Furneaux. I think somebody once told me how to pronounce his names. I think it's one of those names where the spelling is not like the pronunciation. But let's just call him John Fernald, because that at least indicates the spelling. And he served from 1955 to 1966. So it was John Fernald who took over from Kenneth Barnes. And he was quite closely connected to Michael McCowan. They were involved together in an organisation called, I think, the London Mask Studio, before the Second World War, which had a short-lived life, and I've never been able to find out anything about it. Not the London Theatre Studio, a different organisation. But Michael McCowan, who's going to take over Lambda around this time, and John Fernald were similar beings, I think, in that they were innovators and they were really concerned with how to develop training programmes. So John Fernald tried to bring RADA up to date and to introduce all kinds of innovations and all kinds of interesting teachers. And that led to irreconcilable differences with the RADA Council. RADA is run by, its board is called the Council, essentially. The great and the good. So there was this big row, and it's a really interesting history. In 1966, something happened. The official line is it was partly to do with the George Bernard Shaw bequest. So RADA had inherited, after Shaw died, a third of the rights, the money that came from performances of his plays. And of course, in My Fair Lady, especially the film of My Fair Lady, that was quite a significant amount of royalties. So RADA was quite wealthy because of the Shaw bequest, or certainly financially helped significantly. But there was this sort of, I don't know, something happened between John Fernald and the RADA Council. On his side, it was partly about the way they were appointed and questioning inconsistencies in that. There were questions about money. But what seems to be the subtext is that it was actually about the things he was doing in the academy and what he wanted to do with RADA and perhaps how he wanted to modernize it. All kinds of people weighed in. Peter O'Toole, who must have been a fan of John Fernald, is all over the papers at the time. And there was a discussion. It's interesting. There was actually talk about getting the Privy Council and even the Queen involved on some level. So the Royal in the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art has some kind of act, is meaningful to some degree, or certainly was considered so at that time. There were discussions about whether things with Royal in the title, whether there should be an actual intervention. So you can imagine an episode of the Queen where John Fernald gets summoned to see her, and they discuss the future of the academy. But anyway, so he resigned in 1966, and then Hugh Crutwell took over from 1966 to 1985, and that I think is often seen as some kind of a golden age in the history of RADA. I think Hugh Crutwell, by all accounts, was a wonderful teacher, a wonderful man, very very popular with staff and students. So probably when I was teaching at RADA, there were staff there who'd been teaching at that during that period, and spoke about Hugh Crutwell with incredible warmth. After Hugh Cropwell comes Oliver Neville from 1984 to 1993. I know little about Oliver Neville, although I found an account of the teaching at RADA during his time, which is very, very clear that essentially the teaching at RADA is a combination of the Alexander technique and Stanislavski teaching, I think the teaching of Dorian Cannon, essentially, which comes via the Drama Center. So really the work of Uta Hagen, that sort of application of Stanislavski's ideas combined with Alexander technique, is sort of seen as being the center of the training. And that was my experience, actually. It changed very quickly within Ed Kemp's time. But when I first went to RADA, it was really obvious to me that Alexander technique sat right at the heart of the training. I think it's changed, but that was certainly the case. After Oliver Neville, that's 1984 to 1993, came Nicholas Barter from 93 to 2007, and then from 2007, Ed Kemp. I knew the RADA of Nicholas Barter quite well because that's when I started teaching there. So I have a really clear understanding of what that RADA was, how that functioned as a psychophysical training. Things always change, but I think if I was being really honest, I would say I thought it was quite a good drama school. I thought the training was really rather good at that point, was my sense of it. But anyway, so there we go. So that's the six leaders of RADA, principals of RADA, and if we include Beerbohm Tree, that's seven. Sir Herbert Beerbohm Tree, Sir Kenneth Barnes, John Fernald, Hugh Cropwell, Oliver Neville, Nicholas Barter, and Edward Kemp. And who will be next, I wonder? I hope they make an appointment of somebody who is interested in and cares about and values the training that they inherit, which I haven't been involved with for, I don't know, about 5 years or something, so I'm sure it's shifted around. They do. But my experience of being in situations when people take over is that there's always a question about how people will always say they do. They'll always say they value things and they're interested and they appreciate the work of staff. And they, of course they will. They'll make those kinds of releases and they'll always say, but it's time for a change and things need to be shifted and they'll talk about current politics. And that's always going to be the case and that's fine. I don't know. If I was somehow talking to the people who make the appointments, the council, I would say, I wonder if you could find somebody who genuinely means the things they say. Because certainly the recent history of the drama school is that appointments, not always, but have often led to a sort of a radical change which is superficial to some degree, without really thinking about teaching and learning, without really thinking about methods and pedagogy and how you move somebody from one place to another over a period of years. I was talking to Ellen Newman, who was the head of voice at RADA for a long time, and I thought was an exceptional teacher. And that was something Ellen was talking about, that it worked. She was talking about the British drama school system that she'd experienced it at Central as a student and then been part of as a teacher at RADA during its various iterations during her time. And so if something's working in terms of the effect it has on the body, on the voice, on the technique, on the imagination of the actor, then I think you at least would be wise to be careful in how you play with that. Not to, but just to be thoughtful, to be really thoughtful. And we'll see. So there's going to be a seventh leader of RADA. How exciting. Good. So going back to the time of Kenneth Barnes, I'd like now to read you this letter. It's not long, and I think it's really kind of fascinating, and it will indicate something about how we think of RADA, or why we think about it. It came from research I was doing about a podcast which is going to come out perhaps next week, which is a conversation with Abigail Rokeson-Woodall about the teaching of verse in the drama school. So ideas about how Shakespeare and other Renaissance writers, but maybe principally Shakespeare's verse works. And we had a conversation which I think is useful. It's not actually an easy conversation to have. I really enjoyed talking to Abigail, and we'll see how it comes out. But I wanted to try and find out where the ideas came from and how they landed within our classrooms. And certainly, I taught classical text at RADA. I was working with ideas that come from a particular place. And with Abigail's help, I tried to sort of find something out about that. Anyway, as part of that research, I was looking into two people. One was Bertram Joseph at Lambda. And then I found this letter between William Pohl and George Bernard Shaw. And William Pohl is often thought of as the source point for many ideas that sort of permeate theories of verse speaking in England and in America, certainly, and Australia, I would imagine, certainly. So, let's have a little listen to a chat between William Pohl, a Victorian innovator in the practice of directing and performing Shakespeare, and George Bernard Shaw. George Bernard Shaw, of course, is also a controversial figure now. He was heavily involved in RADA, left a lot of money to them, and was also involved in running the institution, or contributing to its running. George Bernard Shaw was mentioned explicitly in letters and documents between the student body and RADA as somebody who they wanted removed. So one of RADA's three theatres is called the George Bernard Shaw Theatre. And the student body, or certainly a part of the student body, has lobbied to have his name removed from that theatre for various reasons, but I think most clearly because of his support or interest in eugenics. Something that I'm not going to go into here, and it wouldn't be something I'd have any knowledge of. I'd have to research. But just to mention that has been a feature or a story within the drama school world. And that demand or request from the student body has led to a sort of counter response in mostly more sort of conservative leaning press. You can imagine the kind of sort of classic culture wars binary really has been generated. But in the comments sections of those articles, so things in the Telegraph and the Mail and the Conservative Woman, the comment section reveals really interesting things about people's attitude to RADA. So if you were curious, have a little look. It's still fascinating to me how much of an opinion people have, really, is the thing. So the letter begins, "My dear Mr. Shaw, your very kind and full letter came yesterday. I won't answer it in detail because I do not want to inflict a long letter upon you, especially as I cannot send you a typewritten one to allow of its being easily read." That's sweet. William Pohl had bad handwriting. "I will only say now that your letter confirms my belief as to the need of most careful consideration on my part before undertaking teaching at Gower Street." So clearly George Bernard Shaw has contacted William Pohl, the founder of these ideas about verse speaking, to have him come and teach. This is 1932, you recall. "There are three brief sentences of yours, indeed, which convince me that I had even underestimated the difficulties in the way. You write, 'And take your place not as a heretic, but as a pontiff.' I reply, 'Exactly. But where is the official backing to secure me, of my position at the academy as a pontiff?'" So Pohl wants to be a pontiff. Pontiff is another word for pope, essentially. He wants to lead ideas of Shakespearean verse speaking, I guess, rather than being a heretic, somebody who's working against the main idea, producing radical or revolutionary or shocking views. So the reply from Pohl goes on, "Panera, you say, is the only live wire there," and you add, "He abhors Barker's Shakespearean productions," that's Granville Barker's Shakespearean productions, "which, bar my own, are the only decent productions that have been given on the professional stage. And Pinero does not suggest my speaking or teaching at Gower Street through personal knowledge of my work, but from hearsay only." So Pinero is the only person, was the only live wire. Just by the way, just to give you a sense of what this RADA must have been like. So, and this is not, I don't mean this in a stupid way. I'm not trying to be kind of idiotically insulting. But so this is the time when Michel Sandonis is bringing the Théâtre de Cannes, consisting of actors like Suzanne Bing, to London, and they're doing these incredible radical productions where they've trained for 6 years in the French countryside, and every day they work on mime and mask and animal studies, and they're watching the peasants working and then creating theatre, you know, full on experimental theatre. And this is a conversation, it's so funny, between William Pohl, who was born in 1852. So this is 1832. It makes him 80 years old. This is an 80-year-old man talking to George Bernard Shaw, who was born in 1856, so a very similar kind of an age. And they're saying that the only live wire at the Academy is Pinero, Arthur Wing Pinero, who was a playwright and an actor, a really good one. He was born in 1855. And died in 19. He's about to die. He's only 2 years away from his death at the end of his 70s. So clearly, Rada is sort of, certainly at this level, run by people who are in their late 70s and indeed 80s, and are all Victorians. They're all people from the Victorian era. They would have been forming their ideas and their aesthetics and working. Well, brilliant people, I'm sure. So no wonder poor Joan Littlewood had a weird time at Rada, and I think lots of other people did too. And no wonder there was such a hunger in the wider British theatrical establishment amongst men and women who were brilliant, including, as we heard, I think a few weeks ago, the Motleys, that team of designers, the Motleys, and John Gielgud and Edith Evans, and people who were curious about change, because this is a place run by people deep into their 70s and 80s. Anyway, the only live wire is Pinero. And then George Bernard Shaw writes, in the letter, Pohl writes, "You write," I reply. So, "You write, for they, poor lambs, of course think that the regular professional way is the right way." These are the teachers. I reply, "Naturally. And for that very reason, the professional element at Gower Street will continue to support the professional way of teaching Shakespeare there, and will continue to condemn the methods of any teacher who has not made a position for himself on the professional stage. Even the parents of the pupils would make the place ring with their complaints." So that's an interesting conflict there between the professional world, the profession, and then teachers or thinkers who come from other places. I think that's still alive. And I think there's this sort of assumption that having lots of professional experience or coming from the profession in itself codes for good or for right. But I think being an educator, being a teacher, is a particular activity. And sometimes it's really useful, of course, to have an encounter with somebody who's working in the profession, but people aren't always equipped to teach because of that. It's not necessarily the case, and it's not necessarily the case that somebody who's a lifelong teacher, whose passion and energy and intelligence and facility and disposition lies in the activity of teaching or educating, is somehow lesser. I don't. That's not been my experience at all. Anyway. "You write, the whole object of engaging you is to get Shakespeare's verse spoken on the stage as you teach it. I reply, yes, but my method includes, besides the proper speaking of the verse, the right presentation of Shakespeare's characters on the stage, and the entire omission of the traditional stage business now in vogue. Has Pinero, I wonder, taken these two items into account? And has he also in the least realised the uproar there would be among professionals if the Academy, which primarily exists for the training of pupils for the stage, should adopt my non-professional ways?" So my innovative and radical ways. So Pohl's concern is artistic and aesthetic, and he believes is rooted in some kind of historical accuracy. And Rada is concerned with the biz. You may recall early on I spoke about different kinds of curriculum. In a way, what Pohl intuits is that the neoliberal curriculum or purpose of Rada, wouldn't have been called that at this time, would have been called getting people jobs, is in opposition to his ideas. Interesting. I have, unfortunately, had 40 years' experience of the almost insuperable difficulties there are to contend with in trying to get a hearing for my revolutionary notions. I have never gone into the enemy's camp without first insisting on choosing my own ground and my own weapons, and as a consequence, I have never tried conclusions with the enemy without beating him. It has been the case of David and Goliath over again. Okay, William Pearl, why not beat your own drum? Fair enough. I think when the old director gets back to his duties, that's Kenneth Barnes, he must have been ill or something, I'm not sure. Something must have been up. If he and I could have a quiet talk together, it would be likely to result in our hitting upon some practical scheme. We don't know if this comes about. I don't know if anyone knows whether they found a way for William Pearl to teach his ideas of Shakespeare at RADA in the 1930s. Don't know. Maybe someone out there will know. He knows me. There's a little, just gorgeous little account here of something that happened. I don't know when, but it's lovely. He knows me, so Barnes knows Pearl, for I once took a class in his room at Gower Street. I wonder if that's the room that the directors still have. So at the front of the Gower Street building, you can just about sort of see it if you walk past the famous RADA entrance. There's a great big room. That was Ed Kemp's room, and I wonder who's going to be there next. He knows me, for I once took a class in his room at Gower Street and showed him my methods. Fisher White and other teachers were in the room looking on. It ended up with the pupils and teachers being in rebellion. That sounds to me like they didn't like that neither the teachers nor the students liked Pearl's ideas. While the director, Kenneth Barnes, was decidedly appreciative and intelligent. I mention this because I look upon it as the one hopeful sign that something may be possible, that something may possibly be arranged for me to make a start at Gower Street. Sorry to stumble, I'm working off a... But when I started on this letter, I never meant to trouble you with all this. I'm sure there's no need for me to say that I value to the utmost the force of all what you say and the need there is that I shall bear them every point in mind if or when I meet the director. It's a letter. It gets a bit scruffy at that point. William Pearl, 1st of August, 1932. So, RADA is a complicated thing. The journey of ideas of verse speaking into the academy and into the world of acting is a complicated thing. And there we have just a little tantalizing hint of the kinds of conversations that may have been going on, and the account that once certainly William Pearl taught his ideas in the director's office at RADA. We don't know when. So there you go. That's interesting. And perhaps in all of that sort of conservatism, I guess, you can track at least one reason why people have that view, why that's one of the views that people have about RADA as an institution. So at this time, Michel Saint-Denis is coming over. He's asked by the theatre establishment to form a theatre school, and he sets up this school called the London Theatre Studio. The London Theatre Studio closes with the beginning of the Second World War. It only ran for a few years, so nobody knows what it might have achieved. We will spend some time in the London Theatre Studio soon. I'll do a whole podcast about that. My feeling reading around it is that at that point, Saint-Denis really wanted to produce a company of actors out of his school who were like the actors that he'd worked with Coppeau and Suzanne Bing and his own company, De Cannes, the Company of 15. So it was more like one of those schools that set up to feed a particular method. So it's that kind of an idea. The school he sets up after the Second World War, the Old Vic School, is a very different school. And although it's still very radical and still very French and still full of ideas, it's very clear that Michel Saint-Denis is thinking in a different way about what an actor training can be and maybe should be. So it's moving towards something which has a closer connection to the work that an actor might do. The London Theatre Studio is really specialised, and people had different views about that, but that seems to be a distinction. So what I'm about to read now is more or less Saint-Denis' account of the Old Vic School. So this is going to open in the 1940s, after the Second World War has concluded. So picking up more or less where we left off last time, this, by the way, is an essay, the final essay in a book called Theatre, the Rediscovery of Style. And Theatre, the Rediscovery of Style was published in 1960. So he's talking about the purpose of teaching. And he says, I've reached at last the heart of my subject, the nature of the training itself, its purpose, its content, its ways and means. Our purpose was twofold. One, to bring reality to the interpretation of all theatrical styles, particularly the classical, and to achieve the greatest possible freedom in their practice. Two, to enlarge the actor's field of expression and to equip him in such a way that he could mime, sing, dance, perform acrobatic tricks without specialising beyond the normal requirements of an actor. In explaining how we tried to carry out this programme, I shall limit myself to the acting course, omitting the technical courses, however important I consider them to be. In the same way, I shall have time to describe only the main aspects of the training, omitting many details of the curriculum. After Saint-Denis' death, his widow, Soraya, does publish a much fuller book, which we'll meet at some point. But this is a sketch. On the very first day, there began the technical training of the body, which is the first technical need of the actor, and very shortly afterwards, of his voice. Then a 3 weeks rehearsal period of a big Shakespearean play, for instance, under the head of the school. This latter was a rather nasty operation, which we called the test. It was like throwing a dog into the water, knowing it will never drown, but in order to see how well it swims. At the end of 3 weeks, members of the entire staff assembled in the school's theatre to watch the test. This gave them an idea of each student's ability and behaviour on the stage. More important still, the head of the school had the experience of 3 weeks' daily work with the new students. He had begun to get to know them, and was now in a position to direct the ensuing discussions which took place at a general meeting of the staff. Notes taken by the teachers during the show were compared, and it was possible to make decisions about the treatment of each student. Considered criticism and advice was then given to the students at a general meeting attended by them and the complete staff. Well, expensive, but what a wonderful way to start a training and thought through. These critical sessions were among the most important features of the school. Full-length sessions were held at the end of every term, others of a more fragmentary nature at half-term. Members of the staff discovered the opinions and attitudes of other teachers towards the students, and the students themselves became accustomed to take criticism. This was very much the way teaching was done at RADA in that period I mentioned when Ed Kemp took over, so the end of Nicholas Barta's time. There were lots of these showings followed by various kinds of feedback, often with groups or teams of teachers. There were also big discussions amongst teachers, big sort of roundtable discussions of students at the end of term. Some teachers loved those, some hated them. I learned they were really grueling things. It's really difficult to give feedback to students in front of other staff, especially with something as delicate as an actor's journey. And I'm certainly haunted by some mistakes I made in those meetings, not through anything apart from inexperience, really. But anyway, yes. So again, I've encountered the sort of the ghost of these theories. I think back to the account. When test and criticism were over, the real training began with a few introductory explanations about the main lines it was going to follow. I avoided giving the students any theory about acting. We tried to guide them as we went along, so that they understood the purpose of each phase of their work and discovered slowly in their practical classes what it meant. It's hard, that, isn't it, for teachers? Do you give people a theory? Do you tell them what you're going to do and why you're going to do it? That's certainly demanded by lots of ideas of modern teaching. But then there's another way of teaching where you find out by doing and you genuinely make your own discoveries. I think we're quite confused about that, actually, as a sort of profession of teachers. I think there are pulls in different directions. The training itself could be divided into three main parts: cultural, technical, and a central section which was concerned with improvisation and interpretation. This was the most important. So not voice movement and acting, cultural, technical, and improvisation and interpretation. Different structure. Each section was approached from a dramatic point of view. Academic attitudes were avoided, behind all scholarly knowledge or intellectual considerations, there had to be the requirements of dramatic necessity. Very good, very good. In developing this concept, we try to ensure that as far as possible, every new technical or cultural development which we presented to the students should have a dramatic justification. For instance, a study of the Commedia dell'arte was justified when it was needed to support practical work in the improvisation of comic characters. Acrobatics came in when the students felt they needed greater physical freedom, better timing, or quicker control of their bodies. To make certain that every part of the training would be inspired by dramatic necessity and that teachers would not be tempted to organise their departments into independent kingdoms, always a risk in anything, certainly in the drama school, firstly, certain classes and rehearsals were shared between teachers of different subjects, voice and movement, for example. And secondly, the whole work of the school was divided into three main subjects with a responsible director at the head of each. Every teacher worked under one of these three divisions. In this way, it was comparatively easy for the head of the school to be in close touch with the three directors under him and so ensure practical liaison between them. So here we are going to find out something about the line management and team teaching going on in the Old Vic School just after the Second World War. And how much thought there is going on about that. Anyway, the three divisions. A, movement. Oh, there was a movement department. The director of this division maintained particularly close touch with the work in improvisation. This included physical exercises for relaxation, physical alertness, control, and general strengthening. Physical expression, exercises applied to a purpose or a mood conducive to dramatic expression. Dancing. I wonder if that's sort of Eugenio Barber's pre-expressive state. Exercises applied to a purpose or a mood conducive to dramatic expression. Maybe. Dancing, beginning with folk dances of many countries and developing into period dances of varying styles. And fencing and acrobatics for poised relaxation, leading to an agile sense and quick control of timing. B. Language. I mean, this is going to be quite a complicated thing. And maybe, again, just worth thinking, this is at the time when in America, there's obviously the sort of the method school is up and running and growing and changing. And that's where you really work with a master teacher. I think that's the American sort of approach. In some ways, you have a teacher and you work with them. Whereas this is faculty teaching. This is psychophysical. It's complicated. It's working on lots of different levels. B, language. The director of this division maintained a particularly close touch with the work in culture and interpretation. This included voice and its pitch, breathing and singing, diction and the correction of accents. Okay, there you go. We wouldn't be wanting to do that anymore. Choral speech and choral singing. Reading and study of outstanding literary works, reading of examples of non-dramatic poetry and prose of different styles, and speech delivery of the great dramatic styles. C. Improvisation and interpretation. This was the thing that Saint-Denis says, sort of gives away, is the most important. Closely related to language and movement. This included silent and spoken improvisation, this will be explained later, the study in seminars and workshops of three main styles, classical tragedy, classical comedy, and realism in all its aspects. Reading of plays of all styles, technique of rehearsals, experience in working through the successive phases of rehearsals under various directors, quick rehearsals of short scenes to develop various aspects of stage technique, lectures to provide an imaginative background to practical work on period texts. History of drama throughout the world. History of arts and customs as they are related to the great dramatic periods. Study of the world's great novels, for example, Defoe, Dickens, Balzac, Dostoevsky, Tolstoy. Study of period style in connection with the technical courses. Exhibition of documents, wearing of costumes, handling of period properties, for example, swords, fans, snuff boxes. Movement and dance related to the manners of the period. For example, curtsies, bows, etc., and music of the period. The classes in style offered a central point of study and an opportunity for common work in the whole school. Makeup, The study of the world's great paintings and visits to museums were a part of this curriculum. The study of classical subjects was dealt with principally during the first year. After this year, various physical techniques were gradually dropped. The study of language and vocal techniques, on the other hand, developed continually, and especially during the final year. I am now coming to the more interesting but more difficult material. I have said that during the first year and up to the end of the first term in the second year, we place the main emphasis upon improvisation. Immediately after the tests, the students, for a time, were kept away from working on dramatic texts, that is, plays. We did plenty of acting, but it was of the improvised kind. The purpose of this was to give them an opportunity to discover for themselves, within themselves, what acting consists of. At the same time, we put them in touch with non-dramatic texts of many different styles. We followed this plan in order that the students should have no opportunity to monkey with the text of a play until they knew something about the nature of a text and what it feels like to act. Okay. He must have picked that little idiom up, to monkey. Meanwhile, they soon began to learn how to rehearse, how to read a part aloud, and how to conduct themselves while a play is placed or blocked. That was all for the first year. By the second year, the students were supposed to have acquired basic experience in acting. Placed rather than blocked. Do we like that? Maybe a little, blocks a horrible term, isn't it? Because, of course, it has the idea of being blocked. It almost feels like a deliberate sort of paradox and cruel pun placed inside the idea that you fix things and the actor becomes blocked in more ways than one. I was like, Joan Littlewood had this phrase, bringing the play home. I think I like that, bringing the play home. By the second year, the students were supposed to have acquired basic experience in acting. Rehearsals could now go further, to the learning of lines and the first running through of a play. Always a tension in drama schools between when the students want to sort of do some acting, do a play, or perhaps now, make a film, and the business of learning how to act, and the agony of feeling like you've lost everything. It's almost inevitable, almost a ubiquitous feeling for the actor, for the young actor in training, to say, when I came here, I knew how to act, and now I've spent a year doing all these exercises, and now I don't know anymore how to act. So, yeah, just there it is. There it is in Saint-Denis School. At the beginning of the second year, the students' concentration would be extended to include their audience. They showed the results of their work in improvisation to a small audience. And a little later, they gave a show entirely comprised of poetry, music, and singing and dancing. At the end of the second year, they gave, to a limited audience, their first show in the interpretation of style at the end of the second year. It's a three-year training, you recall. What do we mean by improvisation, and why do we attach such basic importance to it? What we're going to talk about now is something which was sort of became acting training in the British Drama School before the coherent effects of Stanislavski via Doreen Cannon were going to enter the British Drama School, firstly at the Drama Centre, and then later when Doreen moved to RADA, and then like any moment that spreads in various ways. But if you talk to older actors or read older actors describing their training at places like Central and RADA and Lambda, they do, and Guildhall, we heard Alan Stanford talking about this, they do lots and lots of these sort of improvisations. That's what actor training is. Or acting training within actor training. So this is going to be useful. What do we mean by improvisation, and why do we attach such basic importance to it? Because we believe that on this bare and open field of action, the young student, obliged to concentrate and to invent to the utmost, can experience the very fact of acting and can be led almost naturally and unconsciously to the mental and physical transposition required by style. In this branch of the work, he acts for a year in complete silence without either the hindrance or the help of a written text. Difficulties will arise when in due course the moment will have come to connect this silent improvisation with the interpretation of a text, to use the one for the animation of the other. We believe that we believe that an imaginative actor will never forget the kind of satisfaction he felt while improvising, if he has fully experienced it. If he has fully experienced it. With a little help, he will be able to bring the benefit of this creative experience to the interpretation of a written text. We also believe that in this early phase of the work, all the observations made about acting by the great masters of the past, including Stanislavski, with careful discrimination, can be put to use. To begin with, the student in improvisation classes is dressed in his practice costume. He is as naked as possible. He has to conquer his self-consciousness. We can see his body at work with all its qualities and defects. He has no scenery, nothing on the stage but a few stools if he wants them. As the work progresses, he will move from an ABC made up of the representation of actions taken from his daily life, like waking up, eating a meal, returning home, dressing and undressing, to moods that are complicated by external circumstances. He will soon begin to experience the need for concentration and observation. He will realize the importance of emotional memory. He will become aware of the use of space, of rhythm, of the continuity of action. At the same time, the exercises he is given to do, however simple they may be, can never be naturalistic. The student must find out for himself and by himself, for himself and by himself, how to represent on the stage those naturalistic actions which in real life would involve the handling of objects. So, progressing, he will go on to represent people of different crafts, seen at their work, in characteristic professional activities, and then move on to transformation, into circus types, into animals, even into the world of dreams. The next step will be the invention of a complete scenario with all the details of circumstance necessary to its complete realization. This kind of work, again, it still goes on. It still goes on in the drama school. I know, for instance, at East 15, it was a sort of part of the BA course, certainly, that you would go off and study jobs. In fact, lots of this kind of improvisation is a part of the training at East 15 still. I don't know if it comes directly from this route or from another route, because, of course, Joan Littlewood's work is one of the most important and maybe least understood parts of the British theatre, hugely influential and innovative woman. And it was her colleague, Margaret Walker, who very much set up East 15. But anyway, again, the sort of stuff you would do at drama school still, I think. I don't know about right now, but certainly very recently. In all the work up till now, the student has remained himself. There has been no attempt at characterization, no concern with psychology. This silent improvisation culminated in the use of masks, full face masks of normal human size, simple and harmonious masks representing the four ages of man, the adolescent, the adult, mature, middle age and old age. In getting the students to wear masks, we were not aiming at aesthetic results, nor was it our intention to revive the art of mime. To us, a mask was a temporary instrument which we offered to the curiosity of the young actor in the hope that it might help his concentration, strengthen his inner feelings, diminish his self-consciousness, and lead him to develop his powers of outward expression. A mask is a concrete object. When you put it on your face, you receive from it a strong impulse which you have got to obey. But the mask is also an inanimate object, which the personality of the actor will bring to life. As his inner feelings accumulate behind the mask, so the actor's face relaxes. I'm sure lots of people reading this have done a mask workshop or course. I remember working with Jos Huben, who I think is part of the Lecoq. I think he ran the Lecoq Institute or school and was part of Complicité and also the Right Size Theatre Company. Anyway, really brilliant teacher person. And there's this amazing thing that happens sometimes with mask work where the facilitator or director, something would have happened with the person and then they take off the mask and people's faces are completely transformed, I guess completely relaxed. It's really shocking, an amazing moment. His body, which is made more expressive by the very immobility of the mask, will be brought to action by the strength of inner feeling. Once the actor has acquired the elementary technique that is demanded by wearing a mask, he will begin to realize that masks dislike agitation, that they can only be animated by controlled, strong, and utterly simple actions which depend upon the richness of the inner life within the calm and balanced body of the performer. The mask absorbs the actor's personality from which it feeds. It warms his feelings and cools his head. It enables the actor to experience, in its most virulent form, the chemistry of acting. At the very moment when the actor's feelings are at their height, beneath the mask, the urgent necessity of controlling his physical actions compels him to detachment and lucidity. Submission to the lesson of the mask enables an actor of talent to discover a broad, inspired, and objective style of acting. It is a good introduction to classical acting. It is a good preparatory school for tragedy and drama in its greatest styles. Scenarios using up to three actors were drawn from striking dramatic moments in classical tragedies or dramas. Further than this, silent improvisation cannot go. Oh, I love that. And if you've listened to some other podcasts, and perhaps it would be really fun to listen to Stephen Macht's account of Mask and his encounter with this work. Stephen Macht was at Lambda at this time, actually, or around this time. In fact, he meets Michel Saint-Denis in America around this time. And in that podcast, sort of describes or traces how this work of Mask, the work of the Mask, becomes something that leads to some of Stephen's triumphs as an actor, including playing in The Crucible in the Shakespeare Memorial Theatre. It's a lovely account. Anyway, further than this, silent improvisations cannot go, so we've reached the limit. Costumes were evolved by the actors with the help of students from the technical courses, not from the decorative point of view, but to fulfil some strong dramatic purpose, to prolong or enhance his movements. In the same way, lightly constructed scenery was introduced, rostra, steps, screens, and essential pieces of furniture. Simple music also began to be used. This phase of the work, I'm just remembering lovely afternoons in drama schools doing this sort of stuff. This phase of the work coincided with lively talks about the Greek, Chinese, and Japanese theatres, and tragedies from the 17th and 18th centuries. Before the end of the first year, 18th century tragedies they would have done. Anyway. Before the end of the first year, the students were given experience of choral improvisations. The scenarios were based on strong themes, like war, exodus, crossing the Red Sea, floods, mine catastrophes, and so on. This was to enable the entire group of 20 students to find a relationship with each other in crowd scenes. Choral improvisation made use of sound, the kind of meaningful but inarticulate sound by which the mood of a crowd reveals itself, helped, if necessary, by noises and music. Comic improvisation fitted in at the beginning of the second year. It was based on the invention of comic characters, which had to exist individually before they could meet in short scenarios. This is very much like the sort of stuff that Michel Saint-Denis would have done with Jacques Copeau in his early days. As I said, I think, the British Drama School, it's French. This is all very French stuff. Not very Russian, very French. The student was now given the opportunity to speak. Finally, you can speak. Provided that the strength of his acting brought him to words, but avoiding chatter or imposed and self-conscious nonsense. We found that speech often sprang truthfully and genuinely from comic characterizations. The students were allowed the use of half masks, noses, padding, disguises of all kinds, simple scenery, and props that were stimulating to act with. Talks about commedia dell'arte and music hall comedians were given in support of this work. This led to the timing of gags, elements of acrobatics, all the means and techniques of a comedian, together with singing and the practice of musical instruments easy to handle, such as guitar, flute, concertina, etc. We have now reached the end of the first term of the second year. Wow, what a busy training that was. Kind of brilliant, though. Who wouldn't want to be at the Old Vic School with Michel Saint-Denis? Well, apart from that, he was apparently a bit of a monster sometimes, so maybe not always quite so much fun. From then on, everything until the conclusion of the training, was concentrated upon interpretation. You will have noticed that a good deal of practical work in interpretation had gone on from the very beginning of the course, but in a preparatory manner. The students had studied all kinds of texts. They had passed through the rehearsal stages of plays chosen from the three styles already mentioned, changing their text every 5 weeks. Their bodies had begun to be coordinated, and many of the students in the course of their improvisations had begun to discover some of the inner secrets of acting. They had now to learn how to combine such discoveries as they had made with the speaking of difficult texts. They had to obtain control of their breathing, of the pitch of their voices. They had to experience how to handle dialogue in such a way that it was no longer an obstacle to their discovery of reality and truth in their acting. We found that a few of the students had a special gift for words, and their acting would blossom under the influence of written texts. But all of them needed to improve their sense of timing and the musical quality of their delivery. It is not enough for an actor to be heard. His voice has to translate the shape of the text and its tempo into meaningful sound and to produce the subtle modulations required by meaning and feeling. I love that bit. Just love that section. In all this, I may appear to insist too much upon form and technique. The truth is that to counterbalance the amount of imaginative experience acquired by the actors in their many different kinds of improvisation, the time had come for them to master form and style before they could regain their freedom of invention. Until then, the creative acting would remain an unattainable paradise. Until then, creative acting. Wow, an unattainable paradise would be a good title for a book, wouldn't it? Creative acting, an unattainable paradise, ? It was then that real talent and artistic temperament began to make themselves evident. Where they were lacking, we had disordered emotions, strange inventiveness, and technical exhibitionism. Really like that. Where they were lacking, we had disordered emotions, strange inventiveness, and technical exhibitionism as faults, as flaws, or as limits to an actor. We were in pursuit of meaning and reality, which can only be expressed by strong vocal technique based on a fine appreciation of the nature and form of a text in all its aspects. The training in interpretation reached its climax, and the young actor could be shown how to extract the meaning of a play as a whole, the meaning of the different sections of the play, the meaning of his own part in relation to the others. A young actor must understand and take into account the views of the director of the play, for it is on these views and on the kind of relationship established between the actor and his director that the unity of the show will depend. It was then that the young actor, recalling his experiences in improvisation, had to attack the last phase of rehearsals and finally bring his character to life both mentally and physically. The field was now open. It was only complementary work that had to be accomplished. Everyone could now be aware that each play is not approached in the same manner. An actor has always got to start from the text, but in realistic style, the meaning often lies below the surface. And excessive work too early on a Chekhov text, for instance, might be extremely damaging. The contrary is true of plays of great style, such as those of Shakespeare, where the form of the verse and the words themselves lead the actor to the reality of the characters. It's an endlessly interesting thing, isn't it, or question. And this thing about style, this is all about Saint-Denis' theory of style, which can be reduced into something very sort of dim and risible and mockable, but actually is a whole territory of thought that I'm not sure I understood when I was working in schools that on some level were founded on an investigation of style. All kinds of important exercises could now be practiced without danger. For instance, exercises in speed for the sake of speed, the famous building of climaxes, quick ways to rehearse simple plays, and so on. All of that comes late. You must realise, however, that real work on the complex problems of interpretation began as late as the second term of the second year. This is Saint-Denis in rhetorical mode. Do you understand now why 3 years are absolutely necessary? Do you understand why the Russians are using 4 years? Do you appreciate why a school of acting must recruit young people, adolescents? We aim at the complete professional development of this unique artist, an artist who is his own instrument, an artist who, apart from the necessary cleverness and even shrewdness which is required for the practice of any art, needs at the beginning of his career something of the naive and open attitude which belongs naturally to children and tends to disappear after adolescence. So all of this discipline, all of this practice, all of this form, all of this structure is there at least in intention to liberate artistry in the actor as artist. Of course, it would be an excellent thing to add to this basic course an advanced one, composed of talented young actors who have already been trained elsewhere, perhaps, or are already members of the theatrical profession. Those kinds of other courses do exist in drama schools, of course they do. The two-year course at Lambda being one that I knew and loved in particular. A school of this kind should not exist in isolation. It should be related to an active theatre, the actors from which might find it profitable from time to time to return to school to improve or develop one aspect or another of their talent. Then, in the fourth year, the school should have the opportunity of developing its own company, so that what is original in the school's work can be shown properly to the public. Public appreciation and press criticisms might also help to kill at the roots the pretentiousness which is always liable to appear in young actors who feel they have received special treatment. Brilliant. Also, you know, post-course curriculum, entrepreneurial theories of actor training, it's all here. They're going to have a whole company at the end. One can conduct experiments in a school which cannot be attempted elsewhere. For that reason, a good and daring school can be of great help to the theatre. So should the drama school affect the theatre, or should the drama school copy what's going on in the profession? Another question. The Old Vic School has left behind it groups of people who have continued to work together. In England, as well as in the Commonwealth and certain foreign countries, these groups are doing inspired and successful work. This year in Strasbourg, a company created by former students has been touring the country with plays by Molière and Thornton Wilder. They are receiving considerable appreciation for the conviction and skill of their acting. And that's more or less the end of the essay. Michel Saint-Denis goes on to talk about America in particular. It's interesting stuff, but I think perhaps not for this podcast. So that brings us to the end of that sketch, really, of Michel Saint-Denis' ideas about what he was doing or attempting to do at the Old Vic School, this hugely influential school that still exerts influence over the training of actors in Britain today, a psychophysical training, and one that's rooted, interestingly, in improvisation, leading to the study of classical plays in this complex, complicated, contested thing called style. Anyway, thank you so much for listening. Those people that do, it's nice to have you journeying with me. Thank you so much to people who've left reviews. That's so kind. They're really helpful, I believe. So please leave a review. I'm also interested to see what you say. It's nice to hear. You can contact me on my email if you want to email me, robertprice1869@gmail.com. That's robertprice1869@gmail.com. I love to talk to people. And if you wanted to support the show financially, there's a support button on both the Apple thing and the Buzzsprout website thingy. So that of course is great. Thank you very much for those people who've supported the show. Really, really appreciate it. It helps me to make them. And take care and be safe in all kinds of ways. It's hard, isn't it? I'm finding this really, really hard. Hard being on Zoom teaching all the time. Keep an eye on your head-neck relationship. Find your sitting bones. Breathe. Take care. Bye.